It is 2:06 on Tuesday afternoon. We're very glad to have all of you with us here for a live political rewind. We are, you know, this is the beginning of our two-show-a-day schedule, and as we've been very candid in saying, we're going to, for the most part, if you listen to us at 9 in the morning, the 2 o'clock show is going to be a repeat of that. But we know yet we have very different audiences at 9 and 2. So the 9 o'clock show will, for the most part, be live. 2 o'clock will be a rebroadcast. Not today, because today we have been really following with great interest, as many of you out there are, in to see when Iowa is going to report in. It's been a debacle, I don't think is an understatement. We'll talk about what happened in Iowa last night, why the result totals weren't in. The headline now is that the Iowa Democratic Party chair, Troy Davis, had a phone call with the presidential campaigns at noon. And at that point, he said to them, we are going to report, but this is a key word, partial results at 5 o'clock this afternoon. Elizabeth Warren immediately in New Hampshire said to a reporter, why are they going to release partial results? Why don't they wait until they have the whole thing? That's the setup for our conversation as we start the show this afternoon. Here in the studio, and I can't tell you how grateful I am they were both able to arrange their schedules to be here, Kevin Riley, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thank you, Kevin, for coming in at the last minute to help us understand what the heck is going on in Iowa.
You know, it is great to be here, but I have to tell you, I was listening this morning.
Yeah.
And I heard Greg Bluestein, yeah, a reporter who was in Iowa.
Yep.
And then now we're here and we don't know a heck
we don't
of a
know
lot
anything more,
more,
yeah, than we knew
so,
at,
yeah,
9. Yeah. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the AJC. You too. I'm very grateful you could find your way in here to do the show today, Jim.
Yeah, this is kind of stunning. It is almost like a mulligan, a multi-million-dollar mulligan,
yeah,
for all these candidates.
Yeah. So in other words, President Trump would understand exactly what's happening in the context.
He is,
in
yeah, he's apparently well known for taking mulligans. Yeah.
You know, it's a long day for all of us because of that, but that's why we love what we do. Election days are supposed to be days in which you get very little sleep, right?
Yeah, but you like to you like to have something in your hand at the end of the day,
right?
Something,
right.
A finished, polished piece of work, a good, yeah, lead that says who did well, who didn't.
Yeah,
and we've got none of that, and the campaign for New Hampshire is already underway.
So they're all there. You know who's not in New Hampshire at this point? Chris Grant, the chair of the political science department at Mercer University in Macon. Chris is with us by phone. Chris, you had a group of students that you brought with you from Mercer to fan out and watch the caucus process come together, right?
Well, they didn't just watch it.
They
Some
participated.
Of them worked it.
Yeah.
I had a couple of students that were Klobuchar precinct captains, and we had folks canvassing for Warren down in the bridges of Madison County yesterday, and we've been all over the state.
Yeah, you were in Winterset.
Observing candidates and also doing some volunteer work.
So what I'd really love for you to do, because you mentioned this before we went on the air, please tell our listeners where you are. You're literally in sight of the state, Iowa State Democratic Party headquarters. Is
I
that
am.
Right?
If I curl my neck just enough, I can sort of see the edges of it. We're in a abandoned motel parking lot at the end,
great,
of the runway at the Des Moines Airport.
And what's the scene around the state party headquarters look like?
There's a lot of cameras there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of live shots waiting. And the doors seem to be kind of battened down. And I don't think they're real interested in anybody getting in or anybody getting out.
Let me, before we begin our whole panel conversation, let me just ask you, you were in Winterset. You talk about bridges of Madison,
right,
County.
I was.
Yeah, I've been there. It's an interesting town, and I've spent some time there as well. But
yeah,
you were at a caucus at, what was the, where was it? Was it at a school? Was it a community center? What was it?
It was at the gym of the Winterset Middle School.
Okay.
The lunchroom was also a caucus site for a different precinct down in Madison County. There's 9 precincts in Madison County. and two of them were caucusing at the middle school.
And how many were caucusing in your location in the school?
There were 130 people. That meant that you had to get 20 votes to be viable.
And
20 folks sitting with you.
And because we haven't heard results from the Iowa party, I'll ask you the same thing I asked Bluestein, which is you were on the ground. What were the results in your precinct?
At the precinct I observed, we saw the first round, 37 votes for Mayor Pete Buttigieg, 25 votes for Senator Elizabeth Warren, and about originally there were about 22 folks sitting for Senator Sanders.
So are all three of them viable or only the top?
All three of them were viable.
Okay, but not Joe Biden. And,
but the undecideds, by the time they got to the first official count, the undecideds had moved over with Joe Biden. And he was viable, and two of the Warren folks moved over with the Klobuchar folks, so they were one shy of being viable. And they finally got a Yang supporter to move over with Klobuchar, so she would have enough to be viable in that first count.
So, Jim and Kevin, Jim, as you mentioned, the candidates have already moved on to New Hampshire. I just saw an interview with Elizabeth Warren. She's doing a town meeting tonight at a movie theater in Keene, which is in basically west of, it's kind of between Nashua and Manchester, but west of both of those towns. Bernie Sanders was on an airplane getting set to start campaigning and doing an interview on the plane with reporters. I haven't seen the others. I saw Klobuchar, as a matter of fact, well into the campaign. And early this morning, I saw Joe Biden get into a car at the Manchester airport. So, you know,
Mayor Pete's doing five events in New Hampshire today.
Yes, exactly. Buttigieg came in fast. You know, so let's talk a little bit about what happened last night, Jim, Kevin, and Chris. First of all, why don't we do this? Can we listen to a montage of the voices of the candidates who were all set in their various locations to declare victory, to declare almost victory, to say, I think maybe it's time to get out of this race, whatever they were going to do. But because we had no results at all, they all spun it the way they felt it was important to do so. The first voice you'll hear is Pete Buttigieg, who, Jim, decided in the absence of any data whatsoever, he'd declare himself the winner.
Yeah, I thought that was highly imaginative.
Yeah, let's listen to the folks in Iowa.
But we know by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have so we don't know all the results. But we know by the time it's all said and done, Iowa, you have shocked the nation.
You probably heard we don't know the results. We know there's delays, but we know one thing. We are punching above our weight.
I imagine, have a strong feeling that at some point the results will be announced. And when those results are announced, I have a good feeling we're going to be doing very, very well here in Iowa.
Thank you so much. So listen, it is too close to call, so I'm just going to tell you what I do know.
You won!
We're going to walk out of here with our share of delegates. We don't know exactly what it is yet, but we feel good about where we are. And look, so it's on to New Hampshire. Nevada, South Carolina, and well beyond. We're in this for the long haul.
So if you're not familiar with just hearing the voices, of course, it was Buttigieg first, Klobuchar second, Sanders, followed by Warren, and then finally Biden. It's appropriate that Biden was the last one we played because there are some indications out there that he did not have a good night.
Well, there is one number floating out there that we know for certain that is out there. That 170,000 Democrats participated last night, far below the 2008 level of 240,000 that sent Barack Obama on his way.
Yeah, that's really an important point.
That's an important point. It kind of speaks to Donald Trump's 9% victory over there in 2016, and the fact that maybe you have these people that Joe Biden has been reaching out to, they just weren't willing to show their faces.
Kevin,
right? I would add in something there. Buttigieg does have data. It's not the official data, but every one of his precinct captains will have called back the numbers from their precinct
right.
to the campaign headquarters.
Right.
And what I've heard, and we saw actually at the three caucuses that we had observers in, it was surprising for him, and that he may have won, and Bernie probably came in second.
You mean you think that Buttigieg may have won the whole?
There's a good chance of it.
Or just finished.
That's why they're talking about it being shocking.
Okay.
And the big loser last night is that Pete Buttigieg didn't walk out on the stage and say, you know, we came in a second place or a first place, because that would have changed the momentum dynamics in the race.
Kevin?
Well, listening to those sound clips, it would be a little bit like, you know, trying to cover the Atlanta Braves without reporting the final score and letting every player talk about what great thing they did during the game. So it sort of shows that that is the problem. And depending on when this comes out, I mean, again, the way news cycles work now, I don't know if people, a lot of people will even pay attention.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Yep. I'm interested in the fact that, you know, what Galloway said, that and even Sanders in this news conference he had aboard his airplane said he reported we had about the turnout, and he said, you know, we did well, but we didn't have the turnout we had hoped to have. So even Sanders is acknowledging that that what we all thought was going to happen, record turnout, more people more interested than ever before, didn't turn out to be true.
Well, there's nobody who doesn't think the Democrats have to turn out lots of voters. I mean, anyone in Georgia who believes the Democrats will have a chance here will say that. And if they're going to beat Trump, they just have to be able to do that.
Kevin, what was the energy? I'm sorry, Chris. What was the energy like in your building where you had a couple of different caucuses meeting in different rooms?
Yeah, it was interesting. My contact there is a Warren caucus precinct organizer, and her people were there. They were committed. There weren't a lot of them, but they were very committed. Buttigieg had a big group. I actually talked to the precinct chair who was running the Biden group, and she knew that I was connected to the Warren campaign. She said, you know, I like Elizabeth Warren. I really do. But I just don't think she's had enough experience. You know, she's just a bit young. She's 70. And so I think the Biden folks really just sort of are missing their target. And the group that was Biden supporters were all kind of in the 60, 70, 80-year-old range. The young folks were either with Buttigieg or Yang or Sanders, which was really interesting to see. And all the Yang supporters, because Yang wasn't viable ultimately, moved over to Sanders. And I think that, well, all but, I should say, two of them did not, but eight of them did. And I think that's something that happened across state. And I was at a Bernie rally on Sunday, and he was saying that they had to have a big turnout. At least that's what their indicators, internals, were telling them. And I think the Warren people were very happy last night at their event. And Klobuchar people seem to be very happy about their results, too. So I think the folks that would have gotten some media boost may have been certainly Buttigieg if he won. Even if he came in a strong second, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And Warren may have either tied or come right around where Bernie was. So that's a big deal.
Jim, the interesting thing about this, yes, it is a big deal if all that happens the way that Chris believes it will. The interesting thing is there was no winnowing of the field last night, as we often expect in Iowa.
No, there was no boost for the victor, as Chris was pointing out, but there was no penalty for losing.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's just as important.
Yeah.
Important,
who do you
think
that helps the most, Jim? The fact that, I mean, if Biden did poorly,
I think Biden and Klobuchar. I think
it keeps them around. It keeps them going to the places where they'll be stronger, right? I mean,
well, it strikes me, Jim, that it's particularly in terms of winnowing the field, narrowing the field. You know, most of these people may very well have gone on anyway. But it's especially important because ahead of New Hampshire, we'll have two nights of CNN town meetings with all the Democratic candidates. So even if you had a poorer showing last night, if you were really in the lowest tier, you have reason to stick around because you're going to get some free, some we call it, like to call earned media.
earned media. And I'll tell you who, another candidate who I think won last night was Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah,
because the official start of the Democratic winnowing got put off a little bit closer to his target date of Super Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah. Chris, we don't have numbers. I'm going to start with you, and then I want to bring everybody in on this. We don't have the official numbers, nor do we. Oh, look at this. We're looking at a monitor which is showing us a headline from one of the cable channels, reports that Bloomberg is about to double his ad spending after the Iowa debacle. That's the headline right now. I mean, you know, we're getting to the point where he's just going to spend every single pin, everybody into the ground the way things are going.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing, too, is it's expensive to do this out here.
Yeah.
I mean, we could talk sometime about the long-term implications of Iowa caucus out here. But Elizabeth Warren had organizers in every county. She hired everybody she could. She spent a lot of money here.
All right.
She may have done well, and she might not have. We don't know.
That's
the loss for the campaign.
Kevin, because we don't have official totals, let's look at some of the entrance polling data. You know, of course, we're used to hearing exit polling from primary states. In Iowa, the networks do it the opposite way. They talk people on the way in. So here's a couple of things from the ABC report on their entrance polling. Participants by a 61-37% margin said they'd rather see the party nominate a candidate with the best chances of winning in November over the one who agrees with you on most major issues. But Biden, who has campaigned on the ability to win, only split that electability vote with Buttigieg. I mean, that's significant in and of itself. That's it. That's Biden's entire message. Pick me because I'm the one who can beat Donald Trump. And if he's only splitting the voters who believe that's the most important attribute, that's not a good sign for him.
Right. I mean, it does mean, right, that Buttigieg is occupying that moderate space. It has a bigger footprint there than I think a lot of people thought he did.
Yeah, Bill, I hate to ask a question that
sure.
I don't know the answer to.
It's fine.
Was there an impeachment question on there? Because I would really like to know how what happened in D.C. over these last 3 weeks impacted Biden in Iowa.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I have not seen an impeachment question on any. Now, there may have been. Yeah, go ahead, Chris. Do you know about it?
I'll just say I was at a Biden event on Saturday, and vibrant would not be the word I would use to describe it. Again, it's skewed much older than most other campaign events do. What was interesting is we were watching them put together the backdrop, the people that would stand behind Biden or sit behind Biden. Two-thirds of the group were men. One-third were women. Two of our students were picked for the group. And my colleague and I said, yeah, that's because they look like young union workers. That was the only face of color in that whole group, and I think that tells you what the campaign is looking for in order to connect people.
Yeah,
I don't think it did a very good job.
Right. So here's some other figures from the entrance poll. Among those who cared more about their candidate fitting where they stand on the issues, Sanders won 36%, Buttigieg 21%, Biden 5%. So he, at least among Iowa Democrats, is out of step with where they are on the issues. Biden also suffered at the hands of younger voters. Among those under age 45, and this isn't surprising, he won only 4% compared with Sanders, 41%, 21% for Buttigieg. I suppose you could argue, Jim, that Sanders' 41% isn't as high as it ought to be, given that we know his army is largely made up of younger voters.
And last time in Iowa, he really got all those young people. I think this goes on to point that out.
But the senior citizens, you know, people my age, they like Joe Biden. They gave him 33%. of their support.
Yeah, but more of them participated in the Republican caucus last night.
Yes, that's right. That's a really interesting point. Ideologically, 68% of caucus goers identified themselves as liberal, which matches a record in the entrance polls back in 2016. Sanders, no surprise, won liberals, although you might have expected Warren could have done that as well, Jim. Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren came next. Isn't that interesting, this notion that Buttigieg is a fit in the liberal category of the caucuses?
Well, the first gay man to really score is that kind of qualifies you
in
something different.
What's that?
He campaigned on that. He had rainbow stickers at every event. It was not something that he was shy about. It was something that he put out front and center. And remember, Iowa is an early gay marriage state.
So, but do we really think that if you asked him, if we were able to do an interview with him, Kevin, if you said, so, Mayor Pete, you're a liberal, aren't you? Do you think he would answer that? I mean, I think he'd hedge that, don't you?
I think he has hedged it. I mean, that's where he's gone. And you got to believe that part of it is, especially with these younger voters, I mean, think about it. Over the past few weeks, everything they've heard about Biden positions Biden as an old line politician in a fight with Trump, somehow connected to things in the past, and Buttigieg is a fresh face to young people. I mean, that makes some sense.
All right, let's go ahead, Chris. You get the last word. I got to get a break in, so go ahead and you make your last statement.
His campaign sign on every podium he had was "Turn the Page," and I think it spoke very well to Iowa voters.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way. When we come back, let's talk about what this meltdown in Iowa means about the future of Iowa as the first state to vote and whether caucuses are a thing of the past, and this proves it. You're listening to Political Rewind.
Peter Sagal here. We here at Wait Wait love the Fox Theater in Atlanta and are delighted to be coming back. We would have done it sooner, but it's taken us 4 years to get into town from Marietta on I-75. Join us at the beautiful Fox Theater on Thursday, March 12th. You can also join us for a meet and greet after the show. Here's how.
Go to gpb.org/tickets. That's gpb.org/tickets. And thanks.
Support for GPB comes from generous listeners like you. And Cigna, urging people to take control of stress by having a plan, a period of time to unwind, a location to de-stress, an activity to enjoy, and a name of somebody to talk to. Cigna, together all the way. Learn more at Cigna.com/take control. Does your busy life keep you from staying informed? GPB has you covered. You can listen live at gpbnews.org and on your smart home device. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at GPB News.
So during the break, by the way, Chris Grant is with us from Des Moines. He's waiting to get on a plane to head back to Atlanta and then down to Macon, where he is the head of the political science department at Mercer University. Kevin Riley, editor of the AJC. Jim Galloway, the lead political writer at the AJC, all with us to talk Iowa. Jim, during the break, You mentioned to us something that your colleague Greg Bluestein just posted, I guess, at AJC.com.
Yeah, he's headed home, but he sent this out on Twitter. Apparently, hashtag caucus chaos is a thing. But he writes, a woman at the Des Moines airport just leaned over to me. Just so you know, she said quietly, we are so embarrassed about what happened last night. Republicans and Democrats, we're all horrified.
Have you heard similar sentiments, Chris?
We're going to drop by a store where I've got students right now that already have T-shirts up about we can't count, we can't get it together. The register poll followed by the caucus results has just been embarrassing.
Kevin, that kind of comment sounds a little bit like back in the day, Natalie Maine going on a stage in London with the rest of her band saying, we're embarrassed, we're from Texas, where George W. Bush is from, which had the Dixie Chicks banned from radio for many years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think there's any way to look at it, no matter what side of the partisan divide you find yourself on. I mean, if you live in Iowa or you're active in Iowa politics, I mean, this is every 4 years the big moment.
This could be a huge economic hit for the state,
yeah,
because they get quite a bit of money out of this, starting with the state fair over in August.
Yeah.
So, but here's how. But we've already. I mean, even last night we were watching Republicans try to take advantage of it. And this is a tweet that came from Doug Collins, the Georgia congressman and now U.S. Senate candidate.
Yep.
He says, "Des Moines Register poll and Iowa caucus itself hide their results under a quality control effort. Either the fix is in, or this group of lefty incompetents should not be handed the nuclear codes." It's going to be that kind of a race.
Chris,
I didn't know that a newspaper could get the nuclear codes. That's news to me. Yeah. That's news to me.
Chris, there are people who immediately, when we saw this, and let's explain it just very, very quickly. The precinct captains around the state, more than 1,600 precincts in the state of Iowa, had troubles getting their results back to party headquarters. Some of them were trying to use a brand new app that the party had developed by a company called Shadow for people to report results. When that failed many people, they tried to call as a backup a number at Party Central, and some people report they were kept on hold for very long periods of time. And what happened was it all just collapsed, completely collapsed. And so that's where this whole thing started. So first of all, did you see anything like that where you were, or did they seem to be dealing with their numbers pretty easily?
Here's the thing. At all the caucus sites, and we had students and other folks at two other caucus sites, much larger ones in Des Moines, they really don't have a problem counting, and they have paper ballots to back up everything.
Right.
Where the tangle is that the Democratic Party headquarters got an app. Evidently, they didn't test it at all, and they gave it to their local party, county chair or precinct chairs, and they were supposed to be able to report everything on it. Now, every campaign out here uses apps for all of their technical stuff, many of them are buying them from the same company that the party bought them from. But it is a mess in county. I mean, they're going to have accurate results in the end because you got all those precincts. It's all, none of this is secret. All of it's done in the open.
All right.
And so they've got all those paper ballots to back up everything. But I don't know why they can't count them.
But, Jim, the first thing that many people thought of was, oh, my gosh, are we talking about Russian interference? Are we talking about ballot insecurity again? We already have so little faith at this point in our lives in the integrity of a ballot, and this just makes things
worse. And that's where the danger is. And you are also seeing Republicans casting shade on the result. Donald Trump is going to be doing what he did 4 years ago, and until the day that he won, he was saying, "Oh, the system's rigged. System's rigged." This is not going to be a pretty election.
Kevin, we should point out the Democratic Party of Iowa immediately said there is nothing to suggest that there's been any interference from an outside party. This is our own. These are our own mechanisms. Oh, by the way, the New Hampshire Party is using the same company, Shadow, and their app to get their reports from precincts all over the country.
The timing just couldn't be worse because, I mean, let's face reality. We had months and months and months of all these different things, these debates, these town halls, all this stuff. And at the moment when the people who are finally going to express their will, this happens.
All right. Let's do this. Chris, I know you have to get off, and I've been very grateful you've been with us because I know you want to get to your airplane to get back to Georgia. Give us.
Well, I got to go to New Hampshire on Friday, so it's exciting.
All right. I get it. Good for you. Give us a quick summation of your experience in Iowa before we let you go.
I will say this over and over again. People in Iowa are incredibly gracious and kind and are generous of spirit and have been very kind to our students and what have you. I think they take this process immensely seriously, and I think they really do weed through the candidates quite carefully, at least the 16-17% of them that participate in the caucuses. And I think it's a process that's probably not going to be used again.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for sharing some time with us today. We look forward to talking to you again soon, and have a great trip back to Georgia before you get on your next plane for New Hampshire.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Galloway just pointed out, even as we're talking about the company Shadow that created this app, CNN has a story up. Company behind app in Iowa apologizes for problems. I guess they're listening to the show.
Yeah, and they will be doing this a lot. And I should just to my Republican friends out there, don't get too cocky here, because Georgia has 31,000 new voting machines that are going to get a first-time tryout on March 24th.
Yeah.
And
isn't the Secretary of State also pushing a bill that would not? The audit wouldn't be on paper? I mean,
that's what is so it's something worth talking about.
It wouldn't be hand counted.
We will not see any paper trail in a recount. It'll go through the scanners again. What is the code called? Whatever that code is called. And Kevin, one of the things that the Iowa Democrats can say with a certain amount of pride, I guess, in the middle of all this, is they have a paper trail for every single ballot that was cast. At least they have that, and that's what we'll get reports on at 5 o'clock.
And because this was open, there was no secret ballot here.
Right.
You can call the people up and say, when and where did you raise your hand and for whom?
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see, Kevin, if this impact, Raffensperger's, it's just a proposal right now. It hasn't been vetted. It'll be interesting to see if the results in Iowa change some minds down to the Capitol about whether they do, in fact, need to see paper tallies that come out of these 31,000 new machines.
As Jim points out, I mean, I know that a lot of vetting was done and the process has been long, and Raffensperger has a lot of confidence in it, but there. You get right down to it, 31,000 machines and all these, being managed ultimately by every county in the state in every precinct. I mean, it's hard to believe that there wouldn't be at least a little trouble.
Yeah. All right. Let's do this. This morning, we had a panel that included Emory University's Andra Gillespie and Georgia State University's political science professor, Amy Steigerwald. One of the questions that we talked about this morning and that I want to ask you two to weigh in on was this question as to, number one, whether Democrats, Jim, are going to give up on Iowa as the first state and whether they're going to think about a different state. Some have suggested it should be Georgia. So that nobody is saying that's going to happen, but people are talking that up. Let's take a couple minutes and listen to that part of the conversation from them, and then I really want to hear your thoughts on this.
I mean, Julian Castro from the beginning suggested that part of the problem is that it's, again, not a terribly representative state. And the caucus system itself really sort of invites problems because the caucus system presumes you have a lot of time, you have a lot of resources, you don't work the swing shift, you don't need child care, you have hours to spend with your closest friends in a high school gymnasium. It also presumes that you're okay with being public about your vote. It's one of the only things normally we have a secret ballot, and this is one which is terribly public. And so a lot of people also don't want to do that, right? It brings out the most impassioned, but it doesn't necessarily bring out everyone who wants to have a say and be involved, especially if they're concerned about how they're going to be viewed in their communities. Georgia is more representative, honestly, of the country, right? Not only of the Democratic Party, but really of the country, right? It's much more diverse. It's got more of, more diversity on lots of issues, right? Including, topographically and geographically and all of these other types of things. And so there's a lot of reasons why it is disconcerting that two states which are not really representative not only of the party but of the country get such disproportionate impact, especially given that they bring so few delegates to the whole mix. So it's not only that they get to go first and are not matched up demographically, but also they really contribute almost nobody in the final count.
So I'm going to defend the other side,
sure.
even though I see Amy's points. But I'm just going to throw this out here kind of to be devil's advocate. One, I mean, part of the reason why the tradition has sort of kept with the small states is that if we go to larger states, that means that the entry costs have just gone up mm-hmm. for lesser well-known candidates. And so if you can prove your mettle in Iowa and New Hampshire, then that might actually give you the momentum and attract to be able to attract the resources to be able to go on. And it's going to be hard to find a small state that actually is demographically kind of representative of the United States. You know, I was just looking at this map. Of sort of like, you know, the Electoral College states, you know, one can make a case that Rhode Island might actually, as in terms of small states, mm-hmm. might actually be more demographically kind of representative of the United States. It's got a higher Latino population. It's got more African Americans. But given its proximity to New Hampshire, if New Hampshire stays sort of, you know, sort of second in the mix, then why would we do two in New England? Like, that doesn't make sense. And a state like Georgia is just too big. Just the yeah. number of media markets you would have to compete in this state would make it expensive, and yeah, that might yeah. actually be too cost prohibitive.
So,
the other
sense.
Thing is that, and while I agree, and nobody has talked about the notion of adding like ranked choice voting, because that would sort of be a way to kind of mm-hmm. almost have a bit of the caucus process, but without the deliberation, is that there is this great deliberative mm-hmm. sort of experiment that's going on here that is actually more akin to town halls where you kind of try to persuade your neighbors to vote for things. I totally see your point, Noah, about people who are doing shift work.
All right, we're not going to get into ranked choice voting today because it'll take some time to really explain it. So, Kevin, what did you think? Those are interesting arguments back and forth, the diversity of a state like Iowa. But again, the cost, that you know, these are big media markets here in Georgia. When you want to reach people, you got to go to WSB-TV and whatever. In Macon, you've got to do it. Savannah, you've got to do it. So it's interesting that diversity on one hand, but as Andra points out, you take some people who don't have money out of the game right away.
Yeah, it's just a question of whether this long-standing tradition of people will want to continue to honor it. I think that I have to be honest. I don't think it'd be a good choice for Georgia to go first. Right. I think Georgia it will be way better off being a swing state ultimately than being the first primary state.
Democrats don't want to have to make this choice in 2024, Jim. They want to win the White House in 2020
no.
and have an uncontested nominating process in 2024.
Exactly. but I do think if, you know, look, Joe Biden has run for president three times. He's never made it out of Iowa.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
So there's that. I would say if you're a Democrat, one more reason that you might have an affinity for Iowa is it does you are trying to make the case that you are a general election candidate mm-hmm. and you can reach the kind of audience that Republicans also might be after. And so that first test, you know, do you need two states like that? Maybe not.
Right.
Maybe one test would do fine.
Right.
Well, there's also that idea of doing the first four all on the same day.
Yeah.
That has come up on the show. And I think Andra is a big fan of that.
You know,
or at least I've heard her talk about it. And maybe that will ultimately be the solution. But I think we can agree that whoever goes first ought to be able to count the ballots or the outcome or report the outcome. Can we reach a consensus on that?
Hey, as long as you mention that, we're going to take a break in a minute. But it's interesting that for those of us in the media, and if you've been watching any of the news, cable news outlets today, whether it's MSNBC, CNN, Fox, everybody is talking using words like debacle, meltdown. I've used them in setting up the show. Chaos, whatever. It's funny that our panel this morning was relatively blasé about this Iowa situation, saying we're going to have the results probably by the end of today. Let's move forward. I was interested in their perspective.
Well, I do think they're Amy and Andra are pretty wise. And they're non-media people, right? So I do think they look at it and know that in the end, I mean, how much of the Iowa caucuses is a media event? When I was watching last night, watching reporters chase people around the gymnasiums and explain how this was all working, it got a little bit strange. And it is a media event. I mean, in the end.
Yeah, but the problem is that no results at 9 a.m. is different from no results at 5 p.m. or partial results are at 5 p.m. when your next contest has already started.
Absolutely. absolutely.
Well, plus you got a column to write, right, Jim?
And that's but I'm going in a different direction. Mayor Bottoms has helped me in that sense.
Thank you. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. We're going to get to a break, but before we do, Governor Kemp was on Scott Slade's morning show on AM 750. You guys reported it in the Jolt. He joked that he expected that the Iowa Democratic Party was going to name Stacey Abrams the winner of the caucuses. And then Scott Slade asked him, well, what would you think about Georgia going first? And he said, quote, I think we can definitely handle it. I always felt like Georgia ought to have more influence just because we're a big state, very diverse. It has something for everyone. He goes on and says, the problem with caucuses is I know it's an age-old tradition and people are very passionate about it, but it's also very flawed, as you can see right now. And he does make a point. I've covered five Iowa caucuses. It's a gas to go to Iowa and watch democracy in action the way we talk about it. But there are questions as to whether it's time to retire the caucus system from the two major parties.
Yeah, I was smiling when I heard or I read Governor Kemp's remarks because the last election he was sort of at the center of the maelstrom, which is the word I'm using today, in terms of
I love these $10 words that pulls up.
I've got my thesaurus app open over here on my phone, but if Georgia steps into something like that, I mean, we'd better be ready. Yeah. I think it's that simple.
But you're right. I think just the money issue, I think, would be a killer. It's not just Atlanta. You have to hit Chattanooga.
That's
you have
right.
to hit Columbia, South Carolina, Savannah, Tallahassee.
Yep. That's really
in order to cover the whole state. Jacksonville?
Yep, that's exactly right. Let's do this. Let's take a break. And when we come back, I'm glad you teased it for us. There's an interesting development in Raphael Warnock's efforts to be the candidate of choice, the unity candidate for Democrats in Senate race number two. We'll talk about that and more when we return on Political Rewind in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, White Collar Ambition and Addiction. We talk with journalist Eileen Zimmerman. Her memoir, Smacked, is about her ex-husband, who is the father of her two children, a successful, wealthy lawyer, and secretly addicted to opioids and cocaine. We'll talk about why she was so clueless about his addiction and her guilt, grief, and anger after his death. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Support for GPB comes from you, our listeners,
and Georgia Power, whose employees are passionately committed to giving back to the communities they serve, which helps create a different kind of energy. Learn more at georgiapower.com/community.
And Bach Ascending, inviting the public to a new concert series celebrating the genius of Johann Sebastian Bach, beginning Sunday, February 9th at 7:30 at the Lutheran Church of Ascension in historic Savannah. More at bachascending.com.
One last comment before we move on to state news, and I think it's an important lesson for the Democrats to remember, for the Republicans too, for that matter. 42%, Kevin, of Iowa caucus, Democratic caucus goers, called health care the single most important issue. 21% said climate change, 18% income inequality. In 2018, Democrats got that message. They won the House largely because they understood that. This is a reminder to them that this is an issue they've got to hit up. And it is a reminder for Republicans. They better be careful how they play their cards with health care, too.
You're waiting for that campaign sign that says it's health care, stupid.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. That's exactly right, Jim.
Yeah. And look, we've got a booming economy. And I've got to believe that the unpredictability of cost in healthcare is one reason that people don't really they're not enjoying this boost.
Oh, good point. All right, let's move on. Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, we hope that we'll have complete results from Iowa, and our panel will be able to talk about what that meant. But in the meantime, Jim, you all have a great item that you posted. So Bluestein went to Davenport because he wanted to be with Mayor Bottoms, where she was at a caucus site for Joe Biden.
Right.
And he did that, but he also got an interesting quote out of her.
Yeah. We had been talking about this over the weekend, and he found her at an elementary school and asked her about Raphael Warnock, the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, who is now a U.S. Senate candidate and was immediately endorsed last week by Stacey Abrams and then by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is kind of the big fundraising arm. That doesn't happen all the time, all right? So Greg asked Mayor Bottoms whether we could expect a Warnock endorsement anytime soon, and she said no.
Yeah,
she said she's waiting to see what Michael Thurman does, and what it does is, and I'll try to explain this later on this evening, is that
you're going to do a column on this.
Oh yeah. This will be in the paper tomorrow.
I mean, he'd probably have that column done if he wasn't on this show, Bill. That's... But we caught him some slack.
Stacey Abrams has brought a new dynamic into Georgia politics, and it lives outside of where we usually find Democratic influence, outside the big city, outside the mayoral office, outside of office holders, whether in the state capitol or anywhere else. And right now what you have is a situation where these major office holders aren't being consulted. The big quote... Bottoms told Greg that she wasn't involved in the DSCC decision to endorse Warnock, and then she says, "I didn't expect to be either." Now, I don't think that has happened since Maynard Jackson.
That somebody
was
been
mayor was
cut
that,
out
that
of
you,
the process
that you cut out an Atlanta mayor out of a big decision like that.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you so. Part of that leads me to wonder, is this just Keisha Bottoms feeling scorned in the initial process and not being willing to jump in quickly, at least? Or, given that she suggests she wants to hear what Mike Thurman does, is she thinking Raphael Warnock, as some Democrats think, maybe have a history that's a little too liberal for the state of Georgia?
Well, and that's the other thing is that, look, your normal candidate for an African-American candidate for a statewide office, you know, Thurbert Baker would fit the mold.
Yeah.
Michael Thurman certainly would. Keisha Bottoms would fit the mold. Kind of a centrist candidate, which Warnock is not.
Yeah.
This goes to Abrams's base strategy. And you know, in a way, it's the mirror image of what Doug Collins is doing on the Republican side.
Yeah.
So Jim, just I think I understand, but let me just ask to make sure I do, and that we're as clear as we can be with listeners. What you're saying is Stacey Abrams ran as an unabashed liberal. She did not try to hew to the center. She just said, "I am out here on the left. Vote for me," and came very close to winning. And you're saying that's where Warnock is.
I'm saying that Warnock is kind of a natural outgrowth of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what you're seeing is the influence of Democratic politics operating outside of where it used to operate.
But it's the money, right?
That's a very large part of it. A lot of it is the decline in party influence among both Republicans and Democrats. I mean, you can see it with Donald Trump on the Republican side. In Georgia, it's Stacey Abrams. She becomes the kingmaker here.
Yeah. Another way of saying it is that if we go all the way back to the Democratic gubernatorial primary, you had two candidates looking to think they had the formula for winning Georgia. You had Stacey Evans, who believed that you could really reignite what used to be the yellow dog Democratic coalition. All the rural voters, all the people who believe in the basic conservative value, the conservative values of the Democratic Party, and Abrams staking out, we point out, this newer territory saying, no, the map has changed. It is time to be a more progressive party, to adopt progressive values, and she won by a wide margin because of it. But there are people who think that Warnock is to the left of that based on his past positions.
Oh, right. And what's interesting here is you've got both Collins and Warnock / Abrams playing base politics.
Right.
The one person who still believes in the middle is Governor Brian Kemp, who has put Kelly Loeffler out there as a way to see if he can lure back suburban white women. But as long as Doug Collins is out there threatening her right, she loses that advantage.
Yeah, there you go. That's where I think where we got to be careful. Hear Galloway very clearly. Brian Kemp's not – Kelly Loeffler might be – Kelly Loeffler could be a Sam Olens Republican. I mean the Sam Olens who was the chairman of the Cobb County Commission, who was very moderate, who knew how to build coalitions, who didn't get deeply involved in partisanship, but then when he ran for state office as attorney general, moved to the right. You know, Loeffler could be that person, but we haven't seen it in anything publicly she's done. She's right in the Trump camp.
Well, yeah, and they're basically both trying to end up in that Trump camp, is the way it looks. But I got to ask you this, Jim, because I've been curious, and I wanted to ask you around the newsroom. But since we're on radio, why don't I ask you now? I mean, I wonder about Loeffler and Collins. I mean, they're in a fight. I mean, they're in a tough fight. And Collins has won a lot of fights. Yeah. I mean, he has won elections. He knows how to win. And so that roundhouse he threw this week, I mean, what did you really think of that?
This is the digital ad that he posted?
Yeah.
It was a digital ad. It was aimed at Loeffler, but it was also aimed at Club for Growth, because you have all these PACs that are going after Collins on behalf of Loeffler.
Right, right.
And on behalf of you know, the Senate Republicans in D.C.
Yeah. It takes a shot at Club for Growth, which has never been a fan of Collins and is now actively trying to run him down in favor of Kelly Loeffler.
What's interesting, if we can... I know
we're running short on time.
At the State of the Union, the people that Collins and Loeffler have invited to the State of the Union, Collins has is bringing a fourth generation farmer.
Yeah.
Loeffler is bringing Linda Herndon. She is the RNC member from Georgia, very, very big in
owns a clothing business,
but right. Very, very big among suburban women.
Okay, perfect. All right, I'm glad you mentioned that. As we run out of time today, you point out the State of the Union is tonight. NPR will have it up for everybody to listen to, PBS as well. I just want to point out as we leave today a quote that I think is worth mentioning in terms of what kind of Trump is going to come into the U.S. House and give his speech. Katie Rogers of the New York Times wrote an article about the speech, and she talked to Hogan Gidley, a White House spokesman, about who writes the president's speeches. Here's what Gidley said. The president is a best-selling author and deeply gifted orator who packs arenas and has a meticulous and carefully honed method for writing his speeches, whether it be at a rally, a manufacturing plant opening, or the State of the Union with the American people here is 100% President Trump's own voice. We all know he has a speechwriter, but all I can say is if he gives the kind of speech that he gives when he's in front of his rallies, it's going to be a real barn burner tonight.
I wonder if he loads it into his teleprompter, too.
Right. Jim Galloway and Kevin Riley, thank you so much for joining us for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 9, I hope, with results of Iowa. Bye-bye.